Hey now, how you doing? My goodness, happy Mother's Day. It is just, let me tell you, today it was cloudy when I got up. And of course, it turned sunny again over North Minneapolis, and then it turned cloudy again. And through every phase of that, of those moments, I was absolutely thrilled. Just thrilled. If it was going to rain, I was happy. If it was going to be sunshine all day, I would have been happy. It's just a beautiful day for Mother's Day for me. And I hope it's been a beautiful Mother's Day for you.
What if it
I know
snowed?
if it had snowed, I would have been happy. Because let me tell you know, my daughter and her family moved here about a year and a half ago. And to have my granddaughters, my grandchildren here, three of them, one son and two daughters, it changed my life. I just love it so much. And so they were over here today, and it was beautiful, Jonathan. It was just a wonderful day. I got outside with the children and played a lot. Javita and I were taking turns. It was so much fun. And just to know that you are loved, you know, they lay on your shoulder, they kiss you on the cheek. You know, the youngest one that was here is 2 years old, and my grandson, I should, no, really, it's my grandson. He's not two yet, so he's a year old and will soon be two, but he was the smallest one, and they all just love all of us. They run into their aunts and uncles' arms when they see them. They play well together. All the children play well. So there was a 4-year-old, almost five. There's a 9-year-old, almost 10. And we just had seriously, they ran, we played, they tried to beat out their cousins. It was so beautiful, Jonathan. And I think that's what I'm holding on to today. We hear so much in the news that can be so strange, just not just strange, but awful. And sometimes you just need to find the blessing of the day. And today I found that for Mother's Day. It was just beautiful. My brothers are remarkable men, and all three of them were with us today. It was just beautiful. I missed my sixth sibling, which is my sister Janice, who lives in California. She's a pastor in California, and I missed her today. But boy, I tell you, it's just a beautiful, beautiful day. So how was your weekend, especially Mother's Day today?
It was fine. It was very low key, except for me driving today. I got into a little bit of rage on the roads and yelled at a couple people, and I need to apologize for that on the air. Wasn't very son-like, but I did call my mother and did wish her a happy Mother's Day, and we talked for a little bit, and I did reach out to my aunts and my cousins and wish them happy Mother's Day as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. I know you sometimes see your parents, you know, they'll come to the Twin Cities or you'll go home several times. Do you ever say, I'm going to make it home for Mother's Day? I have to make it home for Mother's Day.
No. I haven't done that in a while. Really, the reason why, one of the reasons why is I would have to leave you if I had to go home for Mother's Day, because, you
Oh
know, I work
man,
on
did you throw
Sunday.
me up against the wall? Did you really?
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Oh
Talk to
my
my mother, say,
gosh.
blame that Geraldine. She's the one. She's the one.
She's the one. She'll never believe it. If I meet her one time, she'll never believe that. Come on. Well, Jonathan, it's just been a beautiful weekend. It really has. I've had
Finally.
so much fun. I've been working and I love to work. You know, it's weird with this COVID because it's still going on. And
Sure.
some things are canceling, some things are just being delayed, trying to figure out can they fix it all. Do you worry about it? Are you back in a mask?
I'm still in a mask. I still wear a mask when I go out. I've never been the most steadfast at wearing it every single moment, except when I'm eating and drinking. But I do take it with me. I had to be about a month ago. I was leaving the apartment and I was walking out and I said to myself, oh, I forgot my mask. And I walked right back in and picked up my mask. And that's something that would never have happened 2 years ago. Never. And it's just kind of baked in now. So I still take it with me. Am I as good about wearing it as I should be? I wouldn't say I am, but I do take it with me.
The numbers here in Minnesota, I heard from someone, I didn't read it, but I heard that it was increasing. The numbers were increasing.
We're getting another variant. We're getting the start of another wave. It's another variant of the Omicron variant. Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to see it come through again, very contagious, you know, but there's a lot of the word I'm trying to think of. There's a lot of I can't think of the word. It's feeling.
Like that
too. there's a lot of feeling out there that it's we're sick of it. We're sick and tired. We're over it. We're done with it. And it's one of those things that we still have to stay up on, and me included, everybody included. But it's something that we are really getting sick of. That's the best way I can explain it.
Well, it's kind of easy to get sick of it these days, that's for sure. But I must say it's been uplifting today for me. And I don't worry about COVID anymore. I really don't. But I keep a mask in the car. I keep a mask in my purse just in case. You know, if you start hearing somebody cough, put your mask on. You know, if you can see someone sneezing, just put your mask on. And it shouldn't insult us. It really should not insult us. If I'm sitting next to someone and I'm coughing and they want to put a mask on, I would say thank you. Right? Because that makes them more comfortable. It would make me more comfortable. But people feel like that can be, some people feel like that could be an insult. And that is unfortunate. That is for sure. So what we should do is just look after each other. So if I were sitting next to you, Jonathan, and we've been working together for years, and I, you know, you started coughing and sneezing, and immediately, you know, I would put a mask on. What would you think? How would you feel about that?
That's fine. That's fine.
That's what I'm talking about.
People want to look at the individual liberty of everything, and they look at the masks that people put on, and some people out there just automatically think, this is against freedom. This is against individual liberty. This is against my freedom to be out there and outgoing and whatever you want to think. And we don't look at it from the standpoint of maybe this person is just hypersensitive about not getting sick or not giving something to somebody. Maybe that's we have to live with that freedom as well. It's a freedom of thought. It's a freedom of mind. It's a freedom of your own well-being. You got to be able to figure that out as well.
It is so true, Jonathan.
Is the truck
so
backing
true.
Up again? This
no.
happened last week. Is the truck backing up to the
house? No, one of my siblings
house?
Just came through the door.
Second week in a row. We got to talk about these deliveries, these truck deliveries to your home. We got to talk about that.
No trucks, dude. No trucks. Don't even try it. Nobody's backing up outside. Hey, we got to take a break, but I do want Jonathan to mention that the Twins baseball returns on Tuesday, correct?
Yes, looks like they have tomorrow off. Just like last weekend, we may be good luck, Geraldine, for the Twins. Last weekend, they swept Chicago. This weekend, they swept Oakland. I'm just saying, the only common denominator, other than them being a decent team and them being at home, was us. Is us. I think we are the good luck charm for the Twins. I'm just going to put it out there right
man.
Now.
I would never say it. I'd never say it. I don't even feel that way, but God bless you.
This is not the broadcaster's curse. This is not. Watch next weekend. They'll sweep next weekend, too.
And they're hosting Houston Astros on Tuesday, right?
That's a big series. Houston, good team. Possibly the best team in the West. The Angels are doing well as well. But this is a team that just came off of going to the World Series last year. The AL pennant. Reigning pennant winners. So it's a good franchise, and it'll be a good matchup.
Well, the pregame is 6 p.m. pregame, 6 p.m. with 6:40 p.m. first pitch right here on WCCO. So do stay tuned. We're going to take a break and come back with some chatter items and also talk about the makeup that was put on my face today. Yeah, think about that. That was put on my face today. Ooh, so much to say. We'll be back. Welcome back to Steele Talking. I'm your host, Geralyn Steele. It is what I love to do is sit here and be with you on a Sunday night. And, of course, our first guest is going to be at 7:35. You definitely want to hear from Jillian Locke, a professor at Gustavus Adolphus College who is teaching and talking to young women. There is so much to talk about. She is a professor of political science and gender, women, and sexuality studies. Oh, yeah. And she's also available for comment about Roe versus Wade, and we are definitely going to take advantage of that. So I'm so looking forward to doing that interview with Jillian Locke tonight. This segment, this very short segment, I really want to talk about my granddaughter, my oldest one. She has a gift to do makeup on herself. She will wrap her hair in the African traditions. She will take cloths that I give her, like scarves, you know, wide scarves I give her and say, hey, play with these and see what you think. And it's amazing what she can do. So she asked if she could do my makeup, and I love the way she does her makeup when her mother allows her to play with it. And sure enough, she gave me for my birthday last Wednesday some beautiful colors for eyes. I am terrible with doing my eyes, especially putting eyeshadow on. It's just terrible. I don't know why I can't get that right. And the blending of it, I just don't get the blending right. I have to start looking at some of those YouTube videos a little closer. Let's just put it that way. But it's amazing. She did my eyes today, and my little one, who's 4 years old, she decided, you know, Grandma, she says, Grandma, I really want to do your lips. And I'm like, okay. So I pull out all my makeup, and she decides to pick different lipsticks. So the eyes were first. And I'm going to tell you this right now. It was shocking when I got to see what it looked like. It was nothing like the way Saren does hers. But man, did she pick some beautiful, beautiful colors. And I appreciate that. I still have it on today. And I think I'm going to take a picture of it when the show is over and post it on Facebook, because it may seem ghoulish to some people or may seem too much to some people, but I think my granddaughter has quite an eye. And she just has to learn. Her cousin said today, she says, Saren, all you have to do, honey, is learn how to blend it in. That's the key. You got to blend them in. And so I hope that she will be able to work with her on that, because she loves this. She loves to do the makeup on her dolls. She does makeup on her mom. She just loves it. And at the age of 9, she'll be 10 soon. She's just so looking forward to perfecting the eyes. So, yeah, I may look ghoulish to you, but I think it ain't nothing but love. Nothing but love. And that was just a blast. Now, let me tell you about the lipstick right quick. Okay. So I have all types of jewel tones and bright, bright reds and a gloss that has glitter on it. So when I'm on stage, if the gloss is put on, you can really see that glitter on my lips. And she just kept picking all of them. And she started going, oh, wow, I like this. Oh, wow, this is really bright. She wanted the brightest one in the bag was what she wanted to use. So she put on about 5 different lipsticks on my lips and then finished it off with glitter. So why does that matter to me? Because she loves to put lipstick on. She asked, Mommy, can I put lipstick on today? And, of course, she will hand her the muted colors because it's, you know, it's a little weird to see a bright red on your grandchild that's only 4 years old. But, boy, did we have a fun time at the table today, just doing the makeup of Grandma and the lips of Grandma. And she didn't go outside the line much on the lips. That's what was shocking as well. Now, my eyebrows look more like Groucho Marx. Now, anybody that's listening that knows who Groucho Marx is, you know how thick his eyebrows were. So one of my eyebrows looks a little strange, but the other one, wow, not bad at all. So it was really a trip watching this unfold. And there we were laughing and talking and hugging each other and coming back. Wait a minute, Grandma, I can do this better. I can do this. No, no, wait, Grandma. Wait, Grandma. Let me finish your lips. It was just beautiful. Grandmother and granddaughters together. How about that? All right, we're going to take a break and we'll come back in a moment. It is now 7:32 here at WCCO. Welcome back. My goodness, we have a great show lined up for you tonight. Thanks to the producers, Jonathan Lowe, Chris Tubbs, and Craig Schoeffer. Our first guest tonight is Jillian Locke. We can call her Jill. And I'm excited to have her join us. Who is she? Well, Gustavus Adolphus College, professor of political science and gender, women, and sexuality studies. Jill is available to talk about Roe versus Wade, her commentary on the role of shame and how it's weaponized or ignored in politics has been featured in the Washington Post. When she first moved to Minnesota 2 decades ago, she volunteered as an escort for patients at Planned Parenthood in St. Paul. Considering this background, she really brings a unique balance of academic, political expertise, and lived experience to her analysis, and she is joining us now. Jill, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Ms. Steele, and happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you, I hope. My goodness. First of all, just mentioning Planned Parenthood, reading that, I have wept because of what is going on right now. I don't understand why so many, especially men, want to be in our bodies. They want to control who we are and what we are. And that's a real problem for me. Let me start with that alone. When it all happened, you know, Roe versus Wade, women got together and we were fighting and we wanted this madness to stop of controlling us. How desperately should we work with our hands, our mind, our money, all of it? How much should we work to make sure this does not happen? That they don't, although they say that it's already done, I don't believe that. I think it can be changed. Tell me how you feel about it.
You know, I think we have to work extremely hard to protect the right to choose an abortion. And I think that I don't know if I'm quite as optimistic as you, to be honest, this looking down the pike, if this decision does come out aligned with what we see in that draft, I'm quite fearful for what that means for our for the right to abortion and our broader privacy rights regarding everything from how we kind of contraception that we choose to who we can marry. So I am really deeply worried, and even more as each day passes, I think, since the initial leak.
You know, I have a daughter and I have granddaughters, and I look at them in their eyes and I go, what will their world be like? It seems like this hunting that they are trying to begin and continue is just shocking. It's absolutely shocking. I keep saying to myself, Gerlin, you should be standing on the top of a building and screaming, holding not just a board that says we have to stop this, but finding another way to get back at them on this. I mean, I'm angry now about it all. Are you?
I'm furious. And I share that view that there's almost a paralysis. Where do you begin? And for me, one of the things that I was doing was, you know, preparing, kind of going over my notes and really thinking about this. That's how I spent most of my Mother's Day, was actually reading and thinking about abortion rights and preparing to talk to you and your listeners. I'm furious, and I think I have the same sense of dread probably that a lot of us who've been watching this for a long time have, in that they told us what they were going to do and they're doing it. So as the saying goes, when people tell you, you know, show you who they are, believe them. And I've been fearing this my entire adult life, and I don't mean to catastrophize. I'm usually a kind of find my way through. But I think it's the time to speak about it in kind of timid terms is probably past.
So tell me what you're hearing. You know, I have a long-standing relationship with Gustavus. I just love them. And knowing that you are teaching at that school, a course called Sex, Power, and Politics at Gustavus, and that's since 2004, I believe. What are you hearing from the female students at Gustavus?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I'm actually on sabbatical this year.
Oh, you are.
I am. So I am not in front of the classroom right at this minute, but I am getting email after email from former students writing to me to say, let's talk. Can we please chat? How do we make sense of this? Because one of the things that abortion is really a central issue in that sex, power, and politics class. And we talk about sort of reproductive justice and reproductive freedom more broadly. But I make a really intentional point of saying the A word, of talking about abortion access in the context of the fight for women's rights and the fight for civil rights. Because I think too often we speak in euphemism and we don't really name this right. And now all of a sudden, or maybe not all of a sudden, but now we're really wondering what will become of that. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that, yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, but I'm guessing, because there have, of course, been previous gestures toward restrictions in the 20 years I've been teaching at Gustavus. And I think there is an immediate sense of fear about what this means for young people's safety and their ability to plan their future, their ability to access safe, legal, and affordable contraception and abortion care. So I think that, and there's an active group of students at Gustavus. I'm thrilled to hear that you have a relationship to the college of students who do work to organize around issues of reproductive rights there. And I know those conversations that they're having are probably pretty sober and somber right now.
I think for me, the challenge is that, you know, I have women and girls in my life that are really important to me. And my mm-hmm. fear is that how we have fought in the past is not going to work today. We are a totally different country. We have learned all of the holes that are in our Constitution. We have found out things that we did not clearly understand when Trump got in office. And so now, you know, we can walk. Remember the Million Woman Walk?
Right.
Yeah, you know, that whole movement was great, but then it disappeared so quickly because our attention is captured. It's like it's stolen by the television or by films, you name it. You know, we only listen and watch for a while and then we let it go and move on to something else. So how do we talk to the girls today? If you were to stand in front of a class right now, knowing what is happening with Roe versus Wade, knowing that they are coming for our girls, they are coming for our sisters, knowing this, how in the world would you advise them to fight? Because the fight before was totally different.
Right. I think you're right. The fight is different because the war against Roe has been, you know, 50 years in the make, 49, 50 years in the making, and it has been a multi-front war. It has been waged at the state level, at the town level, at the medical level. It's been obviously waged in the courts, and it has been waged through this sort of tacking back and forth between of kind of full front assault on Roe and the constitutional right to abortion. And then also these sort of minor battles when the anti-abortion movement realized Roe was probably going to be settled law for a while when it was upheld with restrictions in 89 and 92. They said, that's fine. You know, that's fine. We'll let Roe be the law of the land. And I remember watching some interviews in the early 90s with some of the anti-abortion activists saying, it's actually in our interest to leave Roe as settled law, because then people will think abortion rights are safe, but the court has opened the door for these restrictions in these 89 and 92 cases. And so now what we're going to do is we're just going to eviscerate access at the state level with waiting periods, with parental notifications, with having to watch videos, having to give specious false information, and then, you know, making it.
It is now 7:32 here at WCCO. Welcome back. My goodness, we have a great show lined up for you tonight. Thanks to the producers, Jonathan Lowe, Chris Tubbs, and Craig Schoeffer. Our first guest tonight is Jillian Locke. We can call her Jill. And I'm excited to have her join us. Who is she? Well, Gustavus Adolphus College Professor of Political Science and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies. Jill is available to talk about Roe versus Wade, her commentary on the role of shame and how it's weaponized or ignored in politics has been featured in the Washington Post. When she first moved to Minnesota 2 decades ago, she volunteered as an escort for patients at Planned Parenthood in St. Paul. Considering this background, she really brings a unique balance of academic political expertise and lived experience to her analysis, and she is joining us now. Jill, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Ms. Steele, and happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you, I hope. My goodness. First of all, just mentioning Planned Parenthood, reading that, I have wept because of what is going on right now. I don't understand why so many, especially men, want to be in our bodies. They want to control who we are and what we are. And that's a real problem for me. Let me start with that alone. When it all happened, you know, Roe versus Wade, women got together and we were fighting and we wanted this madness to stop of controlling us. How desperately should we work with our hands, our mind, our money, all of it? How much should we work to make sure this does not happen? That they don't, although they say that it's already done, I don't believe that. I think it can be changed. Tell me how you feel about it.
You know, I think we have to work extremely hard to protect the right to choose an abortion. And I think that I don't know if I'm quite as optimistic as you, to be honest, this looking down the pike, if this decision does come out aligned with what we see in that draft, I'm quite fearful for what that means for our for the right to abortion and our broader privacy rights regarding everything from how we kind of contraception that we choose to who we can marry. So I am really deeply worried, and even more as each day passes, I think, since the initial leak.
You know, I have a daughter and I have granddaughters, and I look at them in their eyes and I go, what will their world be like? It seems like this hunting that they are trying to begin and continue is just shocking. It's absolutely shocking. I keep saying to myself, Gerilyn, you should be standing on the top of a building and screaming, holding not just a board that says we have to stop this, but finding another way to get back at them on this. I mean, I'm angry now about it all. Are you?
I'm furious. And I share that view that there's almost a paralysis. Where do you begin? And for me, one of the things that I was doing was, you know, preparing, kind of going over my notes and really thinking about this. That's how I spent most of my Mother's Day, was actually reading and thinking about abortion rights and preparing to talk to you and your listeners. I'm furious, and I think I have the same sense of dread probably that a lot of us who've been watching this for a long time have, in that they told us what they were going to do and they're doing it. So as the saying goes, when people tell you, you know, show you who they are, believe them. And I've been fearing this my entire adult life, and I don't mean to catastrophize. I'm usually a kind of find my way through. But I think it's the time to speak about it in kind of timid terms is probably past.
So tell me what you're hearing. You know, I have a long-standing relationship with Gustavus. I just love them. And knowing that you are teaching at that school, a course called Sex, Power, and Politics at Gustavus, and that's since 2004, I believe. What are you hearing from the female students at Gustavus?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I'm actually on sabbatical this year.
Oh, you are.
I am. So I am not in front of the classroom right at this minute, but I am getting email after email from former students writing to me to say, let's talk. Can we please chat? How do we make sense of this? Because one of the things that abortion is really a central issue in that sex, power, and politics class. And we talk about sort of reproductive justice and reproductive freedom more broadly. But I make a really intentional point of saying the A word, of talking about abortion access in the context of the fight for women's rights and the fight for civil rights. Because I think too often we speak in euphemism and we don't really name this right. And now all of a sudden, or maybe not all of a sudden, but now we're really wondering what will become of that. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that, yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, but I'm guessing, because there have, of course, been previous gestures toward restrictions in the 20 years I've been teaching at Gustavus. And I think there is an immediate sense of fear about what this means for young people's safety and their ability to plan their future, their ability to access safe, legal, and affordable contraception and abortion care. So I think that, and there's an active group of students at Gustavus. I'm thrilled to hear that you have a relationship to the college of students who do work to organize around issues of reproductive rights there. And I know those conversations that they're having are probably pretty sober and somber right now.
I think for me, the challenge is that, you know, I have women and girls in my life that are really important to me. And my mm-hmm. fear is that how we have fought in the past is not going to work today. We are a totally different country. We have learned all of the holes that are in our Constitution. We have found out things that we did not clearly understand when Trump got in office. And so now, you know, we can walk. Remember the Million Woman Walk?
Right.
Yeah, you know, that whole movement was great, but then it disappeared so quickly because our attention is captured. It's like it's stolen by the television or by films, you name it. You know, we only listen and watch for a while and then we let it go and move on to something else. So how do we talk to the girls today? If you were to stand in front of a class right now, knowing what is happening with Roe versus Wade, knowing that they are coming for our girls, they are coming for our sisters, knowing this, how in the world would you advise them to fight? Because the fight before was totally different.
Right. I think you're right. The fight is different because the war against Roe has been, you know, 50 years in the make, 49, 50 years in the making, and it has been a multi-front war. It has been waged at the state level, at the town level, at the medical level. It's been obviously waged in the courts, and it has been waged through this sort of tacking back and forth between of kind of full front assault on Roe and the constitutional right to abortion. And then also these sort of minor battles when the anti-abortion movement realized Roe was probably going to be settled law for a while, when it was upheld with restrictions in 89 and 92, they said, that's fine. You know, that's fine. We'll let it be the law of the land. And I remember watching some interviews in the early 90s with some of the anti-abortion activists saying, it's actually in our interest to leave Roe as settled law, because then people will think abortion rights are safe, but the court has opened the door for these restrictions in these 89 and 92 cases. And so now what we're going to do is we're just going to eviscerate access at the state level with waiting periods, with parental notifications, with having to watch videos, having to give specious false information, and then, you know, making it an elective, difficult to access for medical students who would want to learn about learn the procedure. And then let's not forget the violence. Right. I mean, we've watched the Dr. Slepian, Dr. Tiller get murdered, the access at you know, the bombings of the clinics, and I certainly saw when I was escorting the harassment on the front lines. So what they've, and then this plan to stack the courts. So in some sense, it's a bad news, and Trump delivered his three anti-Roe justices, and they're doing exactly what they were put there to do. So, that's the bad news, that it has been this multifaceted war on reproductive rights. I suppose the good news is the sort of bloom where you're planted. One of the things that's disturbed me is that Protestant clergy played a really powerful role in the fight for abortion rights, safe, legal, and accessible abortion rights, because they saw the people dying of botched abortions. They saw people drowning in parenting more children than they were capable of parenting. And so that was seen actually as a religious freedom issue. Right now, we're hearing a number of pro-choice Jewish activists talking about how, you know, the Jewish right to an abortion is sacred. Those kinds of reproductive rights have religious freedom standing. The Protestant clergy are really still very quiet on this. So if you're involved in a religious community, I think that's a place that you can get involved. Another thing, doctors have also really, there's been a real dereliction of duty, I think, there. Other than those doctors that are on the front lines performing abortions, most doctors are pro-choice, but they've kind of chosen not to dirty their hands with this. And so it has become a kind of isolated and stigmatized and obviously highly dangerous aspect. But if it could be embedded aspect of medical care, but if it's embedded in a broader breadth of hospitals, doctors, clinics across the lines, right, from cancer care to pediatrics, all standing shoulder to shoulder to protect abortion rights, I think that is something to do. I think the Democratic Party needs to say the word abortion more. I think there's been this, you know, this real refusal to say people are pro-abortion when, you know, abortion saves lives, so it's okay to be pro-abortion. So the right has sort of put abortion politics into everything. I suppose the best thing we can do with that is realize it's everywhere. And so wherever we're planted, we are actually positioned to push back. And the majority of Americans support abortion. They support abortion access. One out of five, their varying estimates of women have an abortion in their life. All of us know people who have had abortions and whose lives have been improved by that access. And it's not enough to have something horrible happen and then expect the people who've had abortions to tell, as you see now, their most vulnerable, devastating stories in order to be seen. I think people across the board need to use their positions of influence and not leave it to women to tell their most private stories right now in this time of crisis.
All right. If you're just joining us right now, we have with us Jillian Locke of Gustavus Adolphus College. She's a professor of political science and gender, women and sexuality studies. And we are pleased to have her join us. If you don't mind, can you stick with us, Jill?
Absolutely.
All right. We have her joining us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. We'll be back in a moment. It is now 7:51 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele, and we are talking about something very serious with Professor Jillian Locke. She's a professor at Gustavus Adolphus College of Political Science and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies. Welcome back, Jill.
Thank you so much.
As we wrap up this conversation, I have to ask this question. I don't understand why the fight for abortion is as loud and successful as it is, because the children, they literally, after the woman has the child, they walk away. Those that are against abortion walk away from these children. They may see about them for a few months, but after a very short amount of time, that's it. There's no, they don't make sure there's food. They don't make sure that that these families have homes. They don't make sure of anything. They literally want you to have the child and just go out and do whatever you have to do. We have 9,000 children homeless on the streets of Minnesota every night. Yet they are telling us to, oh, don't abort, don't abort. And I don't understand that. How do you look at the children and do nothing or so little that it can't make a dent, but you want to tell us what to do with our bodies? You want to tell us how to make that happen? It's ridiculous. So where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think that, right, the contradictions are just glaring. As former director of Planned Parenthood, Sarah Stace, used to say, you know, the easiest baby to care for is the one that's growing in somebody else's body, right? And, you know, once you have a baby out in the world, it requires a lot of care. And the same people, as you say, the same people who are the loudest in the anti-abortion chorus are the stingiest and cruelest when it comes to caring for born children, for born people, and supporting the mothers and parents and grandparents and communities who are raising and educating them. I mean, you only have to look at our maternal mortality rate to see that if we really wanted to start with care for children, we wouldn't, first of all, separate it from care for people carrying those children, right? We would also invest in and double down on support for prenatal and postpartum care, for early childhood education. And I don't quite understand how the anti-abortion agenda, which is so single issue, is detached completely from all of these other issues of life, right? And livelihood. I mean, we can even be Jeffersonian about it, you know, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How people don't call that bluff a bit harder and really ask those hard questions. They've somehow seized a moral high ground. And we've been debating this. I remember in college in the 80s having this question about how can abortion rights claim the moral high ground when when anti-abortion so compellingly seem to be convincing everyone that this is the moral position. Well, part of it was when we leaned into the language of choice. That doesn't quite have that same moral high ground, but people do prioritize choice in the U.S. that has a kind of moral standing. So I don't, again, have the answer, but I think in those moments, I think we do need to ask those questions. When people are, you know, going on and on about the sanctity of life, I think we can rightly demand, what is your card look like? What is your life scorecard? What are the things that you're really working on, right? And how are we putting people in a position to care for the children that they already have, or care for the children, care to be able to bring their pregnancies to term and to care for those children? Poverty shouldn't be the reason that someone seeks an abortion. But we do have people who don't have access, don't have access to basic housing. Those are no conditions to bring someone to bring another life into this world.
And they have the audacity to make sure that nothing will happen to someone who raped the woman, or incest, where a family member took them over and had sex with them. There's nothing, if I'm not mistaken, am I right about that? They're doing nothing about that. You cannot have an abortion, period.
Not for in this draft, right. There's no protection for rape or incest. And theoretically, the mother's health could still, that could still be a trigger for some protection, or the woman's life, not health, life. But that's insincere, even for people who say that they support it you know, in the case of the woman's life, that is completely insincere. Because first of all, it's too late. You know, there are a lot of high profile. By the time you realize that a pregnant person is going to die because their preeclampsia, for example, is so great, or they have cancer and they can't both carry their pregnancy to term and get the chemotherapy and the therapy that they need. There's a million reasons why women's lives are at risk while they're pregnant. So, you know, it's a very demanding condition, right? Pregnancy is very dangerous.
It is.
And by the time that happens, where you realize someone's going to die, that's not even going to trigger, you know, that's not going to trigger protection.
That's for sure. And Jillian, I wish we had more time. We could do an hour of this. Thank you for joining us tonight, and we will be calling on you again for sure. Thank you so much.
Take care. Have a good evening.
You too. Okay. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we've got a great guest, Jeremy Hansen Willis. We'll be back. It is now 7:51 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele, and we are talking about something very serious with Professor Jillian Locke. And she's a professor at Gustavus Adolphus College of Political Science and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies. Welcome back, Jill.
Thank you so much.
As we wrap up this conversation, I have to ask this question. I don't understand why the fight for abortion is as loud and successful as it is, because the children, they literally, after the woman has the child, they walk away. Those that are against abortion walk away from these children. They may see about them for a few months, but after a very short amount of time, that's it. They don't make sure there's food. They don't make sure that these families have homes. They don't make sure of anything. They literally want you to have the child and just go out and do whatever you have to do. We have 9,000 children homeless on the streets of Minnesota every night. Mm-hmm. Yet they are telling us to, oh, don't abort, don't abort. And I don't understand that. How do you look at the children and do nothing or so little that it can't make a dent, but you want to tell us what to do with our bodies? You want to tell us how to make that happen? It's ridiculous. So where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think that, right, the contradictions are just glaring. As former director of Planned Parenthood, Sarah Stacey, used to say, you know, the easiest baby to care for is the one that's growing in somebody else's body, right? And, you know, once you have a baby out in the world, it requires a lot of care. And the same people, as you say, the same people who are the loudest in the anti-abortion chorus are the stingiest and cruelest when it comes to caring for born children, for born people, and supporting the mothers and parents and grandparents and communities who are raising and educating them. I mean, you only have to look at our maternal mortality rate to see that if we really wanted to start with care for children, we wouldn't, first of all, separate it from care for people carrying those children, right? We would also invest in and double down on support for prenatal and postpartum care, for early childhood education. And I don't quite understand how this anti-abortion agenda, which is so single issue, is detached completely from all of these other issues of life, right? And livelihood. I mean, we can even be Jeffersonian about it, you know, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How people don't call that bluff a bit harder and really ask those hard questions. They've gotten they've somehow seized a moral high ground. And we've been debating this. I remember in college in the 80s having this question about how can abortion rights claim the moral high ground when right now when anti-abortion so compellingly seem to be convinced convincing everyone that this is the moral position. Well, part of it was when we leaned into the language of choice. That doesn't quite have that same moral high ground, but people do prioritize choice in the U.S. that has a kind of moral standing. So I don't, again, have the answer, but I think in those moments, I think we do need to ask those questions. When people are, you know, going on and on about the sanctity of life, I think we can rightly demand, what is your card look like? What is your life scorecard? What are the things that you're really working on, right? And how are we putting people in a position to care for the children that they already have, or care for the children, to be able to bring their pregnancies to term and to care for those children? Poverty shouldn't be the reason that someone seeks an abortion. But we do have people who don't have access, don't have access to basic housing. Those are no conditions to bring someone to bring another life into this world.
And they have the audacity to make sure that nothing will happen to someone who raped the woman, or incest, where a family member took them over and had sex with them. There's nothing, if I'm not mistaken, am I right about that? They're doing nothing about that. You cannot have an abortion, period.
Not for in this draft, right. There's no protection for rape or incest. And theoretically, the mother's health could still, that could still be a trigger for some protection, but the woman's life, not health, life. But that's insincere, even for people who say that they support it. In the case of the woman's life, that is completely insincere because, first of all, it's too late. There are a lot of high profile. By the time you realize that a pregnant person is going to die, because their preeclampsia, for example, is so great, or they have cancer and they can't both carry their pregnancy to term and get the chemotherapy and the therapy that they need. There's a million reasons why women's lives are at risk while they're pregnant. So, it's a very demanding condition, right? Pregnancy is very dangerous.
It is.
And by the time that happens, where you realize someone's going to die, that's not even going to trigger, that's not going to trigger protection.
That's for sure. And Jillian, I wish we had more time. We could do an hour of this. Thank you for joining us tonight, and we will be calling on you again for sure. Thank you so much.
Take care. Have a good evening.
You too. Okay. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we've got a great guest, Jeremy Hansen Willis. We'll be back.